The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and by no means reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, a visit with Tom Smith, a former priest who takes up some weighty issues in a book of essays, Church Chat, Snapshots of a Changing Catholic Church. The light title reflects Tom's accessible style more than the book's sometimes weighty subject matter. Case in point, in light of recent news, we talk about Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, whose sexual abuse of at least one minor and some seminarians was known to his brethren in high places, but left undealt with until recently. Pope Francis has accepted McCarrick's resignation from the College of Cardinals. McCarrick is believed to be the first cardinal to leave active ministry after allegations of sexually abusing a minor. Tom Smith's approach to the situation is not to pile on judgment, but more helpfully, to step back and name exactly what in Catholic culture is allowing the problem of sexual abuse to persist. As he writes in the book, quote, "Pedophile priests and cover-up bishops do not operate in a vacuum. They are part of the Catholic culture, breathing in a set of values, presumptions, thought patterns, behaviors, expectations, and privileges that form that culture." End quote. On a happier note, we celebrate Pope Francis's condemnation of the death penalty in every instance. And then we take up a sampling of other issues, including how the church can get in the way of spirituality. If you listened to last week's interview with Paul Crowley, you'll recognize this as becoming a recurring theme. Be sure to listen to the end today when I'll read from a post-interview addendum by Tom Smith about McCarrick. Can't listen to the end? You can find the audio posted later tonight at reasonablycatholic.com. Back in a moment with Tom Smith.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
When you build your life to home, just go have a dog with God.
Welcome, Tom Smith.
Well, Maria, I'm happy to be with you.
I have to say, there is not a sentence in your book with which I do not agree.
Oh, my, that's marvelous. Thank you very much.
But that's not saying that I didn't learn new things as well.
Okay, well, that's hopeful too. I'm glad.
That brings me actually to my next point. It's kind of a gripe. It's the only gripe I have, and it has to do with the title, Church Chat, Snapshots of a Changing Catholic Church. So, I don't know, chatting feels a little less important than what we've got here.
Well, thank you. I consider that a compliment.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. I chose the title. Well, it was the title of a column that I wrote, too, from which this book was made.
Where did the column run? I don't think you say.
Well, it ran just personally. I just sent it out to maybe 50 people that I knew initially, and then they sent it to others, and then others. Then somebody picked it up and sent it to hundreds of others. So that was the origin of it. And I chose that title because chatting, to me, takes it out of the realm of limited to theological conversation among theologians and hierarchies. And these are conversations, topics that I have experienced many people in the pews talk about. And I wanted to make it accessible to that tone of language. The content is, I will admit and own up to and happy, the content is serious stuff. But the style and the format I chose was to be more chatty and conversational mm-hmm. than a theological discussion.
Okay, I get that. So many questions and thoughts. I'm tempted to just ask you to tell a little about yourself at the outset. You're a former priest.
I am a former priest. Was ordained in 1966, and I was laicized in 1974. When that process, I always try to remind people that's not a surgical procedure, but it's a process that let me continue in my ministry. Because I ultimately discovered many years later that my vocation, if we want to talk in those terms, was really not to priesthood, but it was to lay ministry.
How and long were you a priest?
I was a priest for 7 years and left the priesthood in 1973. So I was in that period before the time when becoming laicized was a possibility. And when there was a professional career possibility within the church as a layperson, because that was the era when parish directors of religious education or parish coordinators became a profession for lay people. And I jumped on that bandwagon and rode that all the way through my career, except for 10 years. I worked at American Airlines in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Other than that, I worked after I worked at a parish in Iowa, I worked in the diocesan offices in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then back at my home diocese, which is Belleville, Illinois. Mm-hmm. So I retired from a position here in Belleville as Director of Pastoral Services. Along with that, I picked up writing as a kind of a hobby early on, but wound up writing 8 books and lots of columns and articles. So being an author is also part of my, I consider that my ministry too.
Yes. And you have a family.
I do have a family. My wife, Fran, and I have been married for 44 years. And we have twins, Kevin and Carla. We live near Kevin here. Carla actually died by suicide in 2003, and that's another completely different story.
Which we are going to cover at some point in a separate episode, because you have a whole foundation and I'm sure a lot to share about the subject, which is a timely, unfortunately timely subject all the time.
I'd be happy to talk about all of that in another interview.
That'd be great.
Okay.
So, we may as well deal with some news on the Catholic front before we get into the book, because as we're speaking, the Pope has just in the last couple of days declared capital punishment
inadmissible.
Inadmissible. Thank you.
That's the word he used. Yeah.
And kind of unrelatedly, but on the news front, we should talk a little bit about Cardinal McCarrick, because you do devote a chapter to some solutions to this terrible problem in the church, which I don't think I've ever seen anyone lay out so cogently.
Oh, well, thank you. I'd be happy to do that.
Yeah.
You want to deal with McCarrick first or the death penalty?
You pick.
Okay, let's start with the death penalty,
okay.
And because I think my comments here will be fewer.
Okay,
but I was very happy to see that the Pope did what he did. For one thing, if you claim to be pro-life, then this kind of puts the exclamation point for the end of life as well as the beginning of life. So I believe, and I've always believed what the Pope said about the dignity of a human person, and that killing anyone like a death penalty does is not consistent with a belief that life is sacred and that we are to protect it. And we do have means and ways of protecting society from someone who is a dangerous personality. But so I was happy to see him get into that field and put that particular point to maintain a consistency in our pro-life, which means beginning and end and all the way through life. There are always, you know, conversations about each piece of that fine garment, that seam that I think Cardinal Bernardin made many years ago, the seam of life, from birth, conception, birth, and in through life, and then at the end of life. So we can talk about any piece of that, but I was happy to see this happen.
You know, I'm embarrassed to say I thought the church had already asserted that. I didn't realize that there were exceptions in the rules.
Yeah. Oh, well, good for you. But I knew that there it was admissible to, in some circumstances, support a death penalty.
Well, that's the good news.
That is the good news. So he continues to do some good things in what he says and does. So I am happy about this. And what he writes, I encourage people reading his writings, the Pope's. So yeah. That's good stuff. Yeah.
So on to the Cardinal.
Yeah, that's a sadder story.
Yeah. I'm going to turn to your chapter.
Okay.
Sex abuse and the Catholic culture.
Yeah.
Why don't I let you lay out these four suggestions, as you put them, for how to get rid of this culture that leads to the existence of pedophile priests and cover-up bishops, as you say.
Yeah.
In this case, priests, the bishops, it's all one person.
Yeah, that's right.
This is an interview with writer Tom Smith, whose book of essays, Church Chat, Snapshots of a Changing Catholic Church, is our jumping-off point for exploring the ways the Catholic Church might live up to its own stated values. This is Reasonably Catholic Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more.
Sure. Humans can be a little weird at times, but take it from me, I'm a dog. And a person is about the best thing that can happen to a shelter pet. So if you want to learn how you can be that person, get down to your local pet shelter or visit theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Yeah. Okay. A preliminary comment. I don't generally judge people.
Yeah.
I kind of try to stick to that, and I'll do that here too. So I'm not trying to condemn McCarrick in himself. I do obviously a critique about his behavior.
Right.
But my question is always, why do people do what they do?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer to that is there's probably some pain somewhere in all of our lives that contribute to why we do what we do. And I think that's probably true of him, too. So outside of that, my comments, as you indicated, Maria, my comments are more to what I consider to be the Catholic, part of the Catholic culture, some internal things that we often just take for granted and contribute to an atmosphere where these kinds of experiences can evolve. One of them, and the first one being, there is a spirit in the church that church law supersedes civil law. This comes out of canon law. I think the attitude is that we have the gospel and we have canon law and we have the catechism, and that gives us a superior approach to evaluating who does what wrong.
Hmm.
And that's particularly evident, I think, in the hierarchy. And I was part of that at one point. So I am somewhat aware of how prevalent that approach has been in the past, and I maintain is still existent today, that when somebody does something wrong, in McCarrick case, the people in the hierarchy knew about him for decades,
yeah,
and did not do anything about it. One of the things being that, well, we don't want to get this out into the civil society because civil law is not as forgiving as our law. And so we will, if they even thought that there was anything wrong with McCarrick, you know, decades ago, then we will forgive him that and let him proceed in his career.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing. A second thing is kind of implied in that is that clerical power just dominates in the Catholic Church. And we know that's true at the parish, diocesan, and international Vatican level.
Yeah.
If you're a cleric, you have the power. We know that at the parish level, if and many pastors are wise enough to include parishioners into decision-making and into being a major part of the community. But if you get a different pastor who doesn't feel that way, they can simply do away with the parish council, change the whole culture of a parish, and be fine with it. There's no accountability on anything like that.
Yeah.
Bishops can do the same thing. And the Vatican can do the same. So clerical power so dominates that it does what it wants to do and feels like it wants to do. Another thing is that we talk about due process in our civil society, and I mentioned that I worked in the church, except for 10 years I worked at American Airlines, and their policies and procedure manual was much more just and more precise and more detailed than anything of any personnel policy manual I saw, which I didn't even see in the three or four dioceses that I've worked in. So I think their due process within companies and within society in general is far superior than due process within the church, the Catholic Church.
I can't resist commenting on this, though, that when I read this, it gave me a little bit of pause because you seem to be saying that what the church needs is more rules.
Well, it needs, well, okay, but it needs a process whereby, a just process whereby someone like McCarrick can be identified much earlier in his career,
yeah,
than as a retired cardinal.
Yeah. Right.
And within the church, there is no process. I mean, they champion unions.
Yes.
But you know, there's no union within the Catholic Church.
Right.
So that's kind of what I meant.
Yeah.
And if that means a few more rules, well, so be it.
Right.
But we need to have those better procedures,
yes,
in place.
No, I shouldn't even make light of it. It's too serious a subject.
It's good. Good point. Good point.
And then lastly.
Last one is forced celibacy. While I don't believe that celibacy causes pedophilia, I do believe that since it is a requirement for priesthood, and I know this from the inside, that there are priests who get ordained kind of silently accepting celibacy, but they want to be priests, but they don't really accept the celibacy caboose that goes with that.
Yeah.
But they go ahead and want to be a minister in any case. And I think that creates some real problems for some priest personalities that can lead to particularly some psychological conflicts regarding sexuality.
Mm.
The process of development into a mature sexuality is oftentimes arrested because it's a forced celibacy. Some of the guys choose the celibacy, and for them, I think it's a healthier process. But for the many who didn't really choose celibacy and wouldn't, I think that becomes a part of the culture that creates the possibility of kind of deviant sexual behavior being more acceptable.
Yeah, and you say that the forced celibacy provides a convenient cover for
yes.
them. No
yeah,
one would suspect them.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So that's part of my take on the McCarrick sad situation at this point. How this is going to be ultimately be resolved?
Right. That's the question. Right.
Yeah, that is still a question.
I mean, just the other day in the New York Times, a Catholic columnist who I'm sure you've heard of, Ross Douthat.
Yes.
He had a piece headlined "The Truth About Cardinal McCarrick," and he's calling on the Church to open an inquest into what the cardinal's colleagues knew and when they knew it.
I actually read that article, and I agree with him on that.
Yeah.
And I would love to see that happen, because that's the only way. We got to air some of these things out and get a external inquest into
right.
How it got to this point.
And, you know, I hate to be pessimistic. That's another thing about your book. You have a much more optimistic approach to life than I do.
I'm afraid I was born that way. I'm sorry. sometimes I the way I classify myself sometimes is I'm a short-term pessimist, but a long-term optimist.
Oh, I love it. I call myself a cheerful pessimist.
Oh, well, that works too. Yeah.
Well, what I'm getting at is that it's hard to imagine that the Church, even if they do some cleansing overhaul or follow, as I hope they would, your suggestions in changing the culture, it's hard to imagine that the Church can regain its moral authority. Maybe it lost it long ago.
Yeah, I agree with that, Maria. We certainly have on so many fronts. But the only thing we can do at this point is start at a better point.
Yeah.
And try to be honest and truthful and be open with not only the people, our people, but all everybody, you know, the world.
Right.
You know, and just be open and honest about it from here and be apologetic and ask for forgiveness for all of those terrible things that we've done over the time.
What makes it kind of extra tragic is that it's such a beautiful religion. Mm. You know?
Yeah, it keeps me here, even despite all of that. And,
right.
And I think it does have features to it that I really identify with. I like our sacramental system.
Yeah.
I like our community. I like the way we've offered service to millions of people for centuries through some of our institutions, like our hospitals, schools, and Catholic social services and
right.
relief services. All of those outreach programs to help people in need I'm just proud to be part of that.
Yeah.
And it also comes down to my personal experience in my local parish, which I find very, very helpful.
Mm.
We have a very enlightened pastor. We have a focus on adult spirituality. We have excellent outreach programs in many directions. We have adult spiritual growth. We have a building dedicated to adult spirituality.
Wow.
So just to reflect what this particular faith community has been for 30 years.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it must be beautifully nourishing.
It is. And the other thing, and this is due to our pastor, no doubt, but he has been very collaborative,
mm-hmm.
so that a very skilled lay congregation and community are given all the opportunities in the world to exercise leadership in multiple directions, and they do so. They respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
So When he retires, and if, depending on who comes here next and what happens to this parish, you know, like I said, a new guy can come in and just wipe it out in 6 months.
Right.
Or attempt to.
Even before he retires, the bishop can rotate the crops.
Well, he's at an age of retirement age.
Okay.
He's beyond retirement age already. But yeah, the bishop can just rotate the crop, and he's staying in because he's afraid of that.
he's like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She said, "I'm sticking around till I'm 90."
Oh, good for her. I sure hope so. but those are some things that keep me right here, you know, as a professed practicing Catholic. And I think I'll figure out a way how to do that, because it is a beautiful faith.
If you are just joining us, we're talking with essayist Tom Smith, author of Church Chat, Snapshots of a Changing Catholic Church, among other books. He also writes the occasional soul-seeing column for the National Catholic Reporter. I'll post some links along with the audio of this episode at the ReasonablyCatholic.com site later tonight. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU. 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more.
It's a medical breakthrough, a doctor's prescription to help prevent cancer and improve survival rates. But you don't go to the pharmacy, you go to the supermarket for fruits, vegetables, and other high-fiber vegetarian foods. Side effects may include increased energy, healthy weight loss, and lower cholesterol. For a free recipe booklet, call 866-906-WELL or visit cancerproject.org. This message brought to you by the Cancer Project, committed to preventing cancer and improving survival.
Here the love of Christ shall end divisions. All are welcome, all are welcome, all are welcome in this place.
Well, let's dive into the book. We agree about enthusiastically the subject of who may receive the Eucharist. Just is one of my bugaboos, is the priest saying, okay, so this is how it goes, folks. If you this, then this. And if you that, then that. And it's like,
I know. I hear you. And I have similar reactions when that happens to me. That doesn't happen in our place.
Okay.
There's no comment about it. And although when we sing that opening song about all are welcome,
yes,
you're familiar, yeah, I I change the words and say some are welcome. but outside of that, I do believe that Jesus in the Eucharist is available to anyone who shows up,
mm-hmm,
and it's really up to Jesus to sort all that out if there's any sorting that's needed.
Right.
My point in the book that you mentioned is that we don't really need to protect Jesus.
Yes.
Jesus does all right taking care of himself. and hopefully he'll protect us from ourselves. You know, so in terms of the Eucharist, which you know, whatever people believe about it, you know, is it the real presence? Is it, and how do you understand real presence? And is it a symbolic presence? Is it presence in the community? All of those things are, to me, are possible.
Yeah.
But none of them warrant anyone from not coming to the altar.
Yeah, beautiful.
Because Jesus is inclusive, not exclusive.
Right.
In fact, he argued against the exclusivity that he found in his own Judaism.
Exactly.
Which, had their clerical steps, levels, too.
Yeah, talk about
even
rules.
Getting into, yeah, that's right. Even getting into the temple was, you know, you could only go so far into all of that.
Yeah.
I think Jesus was clearly and adamantly opposed to any of those kinds of restrictions. So, please come and and enjoy our community. And I would hope that any people who are there who are, you know, like visitors and from some other faith or some other denomination would also pick up from the community itself that they are welcomed,
right,
just, you know, from the act of receiving Eucharist,
right.
You know, that the people reflect Jesus' presence within the community as well. So, yeah, I think we're probably on the very same page there.
Okay. Now, maybe this is a little more nuanced. Pope Francis, you are an unadulterated fan, and you do express some concern. You wish he was more proactive when it comes to ordaining women, say. We should probably, since the book is how many years old now? Let's see. It was printed in 2015.
Oh, 2015, yeah.
And you do kind of update the parts about Pope Francis, which I think is really helpful. But probably it needs further updating now, even just 3 years in.
So yes, of Pope Francis. And I continue to be a fan of his. In the context particularly of our past, in our recent past, in light of previous this century popes, for example, outside of John the 23rd, Francis has implemented in his own style, in his own way, and in some of the policies that he's made, and in his writings, an approach to Christianity and Catholicism that more clearly exemplifies Second Vatican Council, which is my formative era. I am disappointed that he has not kind of regionalized the governance of the church more quickly, that he has not ordained women, and even, you know, let's at least start with women deaconesses, ordained married men, and of course ordained women. I am disappointed that the pace there is way too slow for me. And if it's headed in that direction, and I like, because I am optimistic about this, that in 50 years we'll see all those things. But so that's my optimism showing.
Yes.
But I hope he's in a position to get it there faster. Because I'm not sure how long he's going to live.
Right. Or whether we'll see the likes of him again.
Here's a hopeful thing. I think this is true, that the number of electing cardinals, I think he has now named 40% of them.
Oh.
So that's encouraging that in the next conclave, they may have someone of a similar approach that Francis has. Had he died a couple years ago, I think that would not have happened. But now, every year, and he names some more cardinals, and most of them, I think, are in line with his way of thinking, at least in general. So maybe the future is more hopeful. There I go again, being hopeful.
If you could, as a married man, would you work again as a priest?
I would encourage that change, but I personally would not.
Oh.
And the reason I say that is I think my calling is more to lay ministry.
Okay.
I like being a priest, but I'm not I'm not a primarily focused liturgical priest.
Okay.
Celebrant. I love preaching and I love teaching, but our Eucharistic, celebrating the Eucharist as my primary focus is not where I'm at, and I discovered that about myself some years ago. Priest. Now, a lot of my classmates who left disagree with me on that. They would do it in a minute.
Kind of on the spirituality front, the personal spirituality front, you recommend a 10-year spiritual journey.
Yeah.
A lot of reading, a lot of meditating over the course of 10 years. God, well, I hope I have that many left in me. But
yeah, well, me too. But but what I'm saying by that is that there's no end to our spiritual journey, and I don't believe, and not because I'm still doing that now. I've come to some insights that I didn't have 5 years ago, 10 years ago, some directions my soul was taking me in, if you will, mm-hmm. that I didn't have then. And what I had suggested in the book, you know, about putting a 10-year, you know, spending a year on God and a year on Jesus and a year on how we live this, I think that would be literally helpful. But it's also metaphorical, mm-hmm. Because I think, like, just take the God question. We jump pretty quickly to saying, well, here's how God is. God is this, God is that. And in traditional Catholic theology, God is Trinity, God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And then we kind of move on. I think we need to slow that whole thing down and really try to appreciate what we believe about God, because yes. ultimately, and this is the starting point, God is mystery,
right?
And we can't say hardly anything about it. You know, about how that being is, what are the qualities of God? I'm much more into sitting with the mystery,
yes,
than, you know, analyzing theologically and coming to theological conclusions, but sitting and wondering at and marveling at the mystery. I think that for our spirituals, for our souls, that is a more rewarding time frame.
Yeah.
That's a more rewarding way to use our time.
So interesting, because, not to interrupt, but it occurs to me that the episode of this program that precedes ours was an interview with a Jesuit theologian named Father Paul Crowley, and we talked about his book, The Unmoored God, Believing in a Time of Dislocation. And he gets at this very thing that it's just too glib to, and he worries about, I think he calls it ecclesiolatry, you know?
Oh, yeah, idolatry of the church.
And it's kind of at the expense of delving into the mystery, like you're saying. So you two are on the same page. I recommend the book very highly. It's a thin book, pretty deep, maybe not so deep for you.
Well, no, I'm sure it is. What's the title again?
It's called The Unmoored God.
Unmoored.
Okay. Unmoored God.
Yeah.
Believing in a Time of Dislocation.
Yeah.
And his name is Paul Crowley. He's a brilliant but very likable fellow.
Well, that's
like
wonderful.
You.
Yeah. Oh, well, good. It sounds like we're kindred spirits.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my point in that, and I call it kind of benefiting from the gaps.
Exactly, and that's the next item on my list, where you're talking about, yeah, the catechism's all well and good, but it's in the gaps.
that's
talk about that.
Well, what I mean is that, again, we not only go to glib answers about God, but we go to pretty glib answers about almost everything. And not everything is so buttoned up as our answer, our catechism answers imply. So, and if you're going to live life in reality, there are gaps, and dealing with those gaps and appreciating their value and struggling with the struggles are enriching, I think, spiritual exercises. I think it's Richard Rohr who says that, you know, we learn the most in great love and in great pain and great suffering. Those are the two arenas in which we learn the most about ourselves and others in our relationships. And I believe that's true. But we often try to short change and quickly get through, particularly the painful times. I hope we can get through painful times. But the benefit there is that it lets us know how powerless we are.
Yeah.
And that out of that powerlessness is where we can, I think, grow spiritually.
Yes, and this is what Father Crowley says about the poor, for instance, that they're, because they're thrust upon their own resources, they're open, you know, more
yes.
open than some of us with our layers and layers of...
and it's hard to get through those layers.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Let me say one more thing quickly about that.
Don't take your time.
I think one of our main problems is that the apostles and the disciples experienced Jesus. They had a religious experience surrounding this guy, Jesus, that led them to question what they're all about. Mm. And in that questioning and then committing to their experience of Jesus, they taught some things about mm-hmm. Jesus, and mm-hmm. Jesus taught some things, obviously. But they had the experience of the person. And then, as the centuries went on, the church, reflecting on what they said,
yeah.
we created dogma, and we created doctrine, and we created teachings. So when it comes to our turn, and we're born, we're given information and education and teaching and learnings and things to believe long before we have any religious experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we have reversed the natural process of religious experience followed by interpretation of that experience, mm-hmm. which leads to, you know, healthy education and information to help you understand and appreciate and value and marvel at the experience that you have.
Yeah.
But our normal experience of people centuries later is that we are born into a family who teaches us and we go to school where
yeah.
we learn things before we have any real genuine religious experience.
Right, right.
We get
right.
it backwards. And,
yeah.
And I think that creates a lot of catechism Catholics.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It makes me think
to, yeah.
that people with no faith who may or may not be flailing around out there are at an advantage because they're going to be seeking instead of just receiving.
Yeah, if they're seeking, and I think those people are out there, but there, I think there are people who aren't even seeking. But
yeah.
but there are people who are seeking and searching for some comments about the experiences they're having.
Right.
And I think we can deal with them if we take their experiences, validate them, and try to put some words on their experiences that they're struggling to find.
Yeah.
And I think we got some good words
yes.
that can help people find meaning in life and shared experiences that can make life very meaningful, mission-oriented, and joyful.
Yeah, beautiful.
I think that's possible.
Yeah. Well, getting back a little bit to the church,
okay.
you kind of lay out some options for us cranky Catholics. There are effectively, as you see it, three. We
okay.
can leave the church,
yeah.
we can stay and ignore what's troubling us,
yeah.
or we can stay and, as you put it, prophetically confront it.
Yeah.
You know, which is work, I have to say.
Which is work. I guess there's...
It's like, oh my gosh, I have to work at this.
Yeah.
Life is hard enough.
Well, you're doing it right now, though, Maria.
Okay, thank you.
You're doing it right now. But I'm not sure if there are other alternatives. I think those are three general ones. People who leave, formally leave the church, they find some of them. find a spiritual home in some other denomination or in some other way of life, and their spiritual journey continues. But they so it isn't like leave the Catholic Church.
Well, that's true.
You're lost. You know.
That's
you
true.
You can't find it. You can find some other ways, paths, if you will. You know. Sometimes I think that the Catholic Church, our institutional church, pitches its main message to the least spiritually mature level, and all the rules and all the things that their primary audience there are people who are just beginning a spiritual journey, and they need to have the they need to be contained. They need to know what they can't do, and so they. But they're, all the dogma and all the doctrine and all the rules and that seem to be aimed that way. And when people get through that phase of development of spiritual growth, and they're at another level of spiritual growth where they can handle ambiguity, where they can handle their own sin, where they can handle difficulties in others, you know, where questions can be raised and not answered, and it's still okay. You know, that's a spiritual level that supersedes, I think, what the primary message of the Roman Catholic Church focuses. And I think that's one reason why people leave, is that they have outgrown their view over that. Now, it is historically true that we can find within our tradition all levels of spiritual development and all paths to this spiritual heights. Some of our saints are good examples of all that.
Yes.
So that is in our tradition, but you have to search it out and find it on your own if you're going to make use of that. Some people just find they're just disappointed in their local pastor, in the rules and regulations, and so. So they leave and they find a more welcoming kind of community elsewhere, and that nourishes them. And I say, I wherever they go, I hope something is nourishing their spiritual life. And those who don't connect with another denomination or another faith or whatever, and they kind of float out there, I hope they find something meaningful for them, because I do believe, as human beings, we are spiritual beings trying to be human. Rather than human beings trying to be spiritual.
Very good. One thing I think the church could make more of is the contemplative tradition. You know, I mean, people are fleeing to the East just to learn how to sit still when we've got our own beautiful contemplative models.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you completely. And that flee to the East, I see a lot of that myself, and you're absolutely correct. But I think the problem there is that contemplative experience is part of our hierarchical structure. We have so, you know, it's priests, monks, and nuns who do those things. And that's placed in our pyramid, our hierarchical pyramid, at a level above the layperson. And it doesn't, they haven't figured out a way how to make that rich tradition really available to the lay folks. So, you know, it's almost like you have to become one of them in order to experience their experience of contemplative life, as opposed to, here's a path to contemplation and meditation and nourishing your spiritual life through that. Here's a way you can do that as lay people. There are some efforts in those regards, but it's not a primary theme of Roman Catholicism at
this
time.
In fact, that leads me to, we have so few minutes left, it's awful, but you talk about Catholic identity. You devote a chapter to it. What is pressing on your brain about Catholic identity, if you can summarize it?
A quick run at that. It's prior Catholics were identified by what they did or didn't do. They didn't eat meat on Friday. They went to Mass on Sunday. Women wore hats at church, and that that's how we identified ourselves. That's not a good way to do it. And how do we kind of brand ourselves? How do we know who we are? And for Christianity, I think the logo, if you will, to put it in marketing terms, the logo for Christianity is the cross or the crucifix. But for Catholicism, the logo for Catholicism, and I think you might agree with this, is Vatican City, St. Peter's Basilica. Hmm. That's the picture that is used to represent Catholicism mm-hmm. around the world. And when people see that, that's what Catholic is.
Yeah.
So, that's a terrible identity. What I might suggest, you know, in terms of that, is we need a new logo. And I picture the logo, we need the artist to come up with this, certainly not that, but I picture the logo as a circle of people representing a lot of ethnic groups, obviously male, female, and a few kids in there too,
mm-hmm.
but a circle of people, and then we try to represent different parts of who we are at different times. The logo changes when, let's say, it's a teaching church. So there's a representative for that. There's a service representative. How do we serve anybody in need? It is a prayerful church. There's another little symbol in the circle that represents that. Anyway, what I'm saying is that we need a new identity that revolves around our experience of community as faith people, our service to others, and what we teach, which I would base it on the Beatitudes in Matthew 25 as the core teaching. I'm just saying that our identity has been shaped by the Roman Empire and not by the gospel.
Wow. Oh, so many things. I wish we could talk longer, but we're out of time. I just want to thank you so much and urge listeners to pick up this terrific book. It's really going to speak to you if you're a cranky Catholic like me, especially. And your optimism, Tom, is really helpful. So,
well, thank you very much, Maria. I, as you can hear, I'll talk about this stuff forever and ever, amen.
but
thank you for this opportunity, and I enjoyed meeting you this way, too.
It's great. We'll talk again.
All right, sure.
That was a visit with Tom Smith, a former priest whose book of essays, Church Chat, Snapshots of a Changing Catholic Church, takes up just about every issue that rankles us progressive-minded Catholics. As I mentioned in my intro, Tom offered an addendum to his interview, which I'll read for you now. Quote, "Another factor in the McCarrick discussion and many other issues related to Catholic hierarchy is this. The theology means that every bishop in the world is a direct report only to the Pope, and that is much more than theology. It is a specific and destructive practice for centuries. The Pope has over 6,000 direct reports, my latest count. From a management perspective, that is absolutely ridiculous, but that is the practical reality. In effect, there is no accountability. When I mentioned regionalization as one of the disappointing, slow-paced actions for Francis, that's one of the things I meant. McCarrick was not accountable to anyone during his long reign and rise, but he obviously had a quote-unquote mentor who, promoting him up the hierarchy, but he never had a supervisor, nor does any bishop. And depending on the local bishop, priests are similarly unaccountable." End quote. Thanks for that, Tom. And here's to the hierarchies getting the message. Reminding listeners that if you missed any of the episode, you can find the audio posted later tonight at thereasonablycatholic.com blog, along with other bells and whistles of interest. Be sure to tune in next week, when our guest will be the author of another way cool book, The Monk's Record Player, Thomas Merton, Bob Dylan, and The Perilous Summer of 1966. Till then, I'm Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening. Now stay tuned for The Jive at 5, followed by Wonderland with DJ Cheshire Cat.